Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Ian Tuttle of National Review, who is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And two of them certainly are deeply, deeply depressing. And Ian, let's start with the good martini. We use that in quotation marks because oftentimes friction and bad news for Democrats, which is not necessarily good news for conservatives, can pass for the good martini. And that's the case right now on the Democratic side of the aisle. Last night, the Associated Press announced that thanks to the recent Puerto Rico primary and some unbound delegates making decisions, Hillary Clinton now has the number of delegates needed to become the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. Today's the last major primary day, California and New Jersey, the biggest delegate prizes, but not so fast. Everyone wondering how fast Bernie Sanders is going to get out? Pack a lunch, because it's not happening anytime soon. This is according to Bernie Sanders spokesman Michael Briggs on Monday night. Quote, it is unfortunate that the media, in a rush to judgment, are ignoring the Democratic National Committee's clear statement that it is wrong to count the votes of superdelegates before they actually vote at the convention this summer. Secretary Clinton does not have and will not have the requisite number of pledged delegates to secure the nomination. She will be dependent on superdelegates who do not vote until July 25th and who can change their minds between now and then. They include more than 400 superdelegates who endorsed Secretary Clinton 10 months before the first caucuses and primaries and long before any other candidate was in the race. So it's good that he's highlighting kind of the corrupt way many people see the Democratic nominating process unfolding, although ultimately most of those superdelegates aren't going anywhere since Hillary will still have the majority of the pledged delegates as well. There's no real reason other than a looming indictment, perhaps, and the fact that she's doing worse than Bernie in the polls as to why they could possibly switch to his side. But it's fun to watch them be dysfunctional, perhaps, for another month and a half.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see something right along those lines. I mean, it's absolutely true that the DNC stacked this from the beginning. I mean, you know, debates on Christmas night and Super Bowl Sunday and, you know, whenever the rest of them were clearly designed to make Hillary the candidate. So Bernie has a valid grudge here. But it's worth remembering in sort of the broad arc of this race, too, that Bernie was a protest candidate who jumped into this race because every other legitimate candidate had basically been boxed out. Cuomo and Warren and Biden, anybody else who could actually put up a serious contest. And a funny thing happened, which is that Bernie turned into a real candidate. That's a really significant, it's a significant marker in Democratic politics. So what you're going to see for the next month and a half, I would suspect, is Bernie fans. First, you're going to see Hillary trying to exert pressure to get Bernie to drop out and throw his support behind her. I suspect that doesn't happen until the convention for a couple reasons. One, Bernie fans like this stand. Bernie fans are not Hillary fans, and they're not going to be thrilled with the prospect of rallying to a candidate just because she has the numbers, just because, you know, she's quote unquote inevitable, right? I mean, this has been the argument from the beginning. There really is a deep fracture on the left right now. And so Bernie fans are going to want him to stick around because they're going to want him to exert pressure on the platform when it comes to the actual convention. And that, I think, is going to be the lasting impact of the Sanders candidacy, is he's managed to move the whole party left. And Hillary Clinton is going to have a foot in either camp in sort of her moderate, you know, outreach to disaffected Republicans, even, you know, folks who folks in the middle who can't stomach a Trump vote, as well as these Bernie voters, these very, very progressive voters who didn't like her from the beginning, don't like her now. She's going to have to try and persuade and cajole them to get behind her. That's obviously easier with Trump as the alternative. What it suggests, again, is that the whole structure is moving leftward, and I think Bernie is going to take the opportunity to push it to the very, very last moment.
Like Jim and I said earlier this week, Hillary Clinton will be whatever you need her to be at that particular moment. And in Jim's classic parlance, These are my principles. And if you don't like them, I have others.
Exactly. If our listeners have not read it, there's an amazing, amazing piece at The Onion that came out last week. And it's Hillary Clinton. Let me take a moment to be honest with you. I just want everyone to know that what you believe is what I believe. And the whole, I mean, it's just an amazing piece of satire that I think is closer to the actual ethos of the Hillary campaign than anyone in serious political journalism has managed the entire season.
Well, that's certainly true. She gave them 8 minutes yesterday, and the questions were hard hitters like, what does it feel like that you're about to make history? And
right.
What will the president's endorsement mean for you? And all, what do you think about superdelegates and all this stuff? That was the toughest question, actually. Nothing about the fact that she's under FBI investigation or her Clinton Foundation corruption allegations and all that kind of stuff. But what would you expect?
Yeah, the same hard-hitting press that asked Trump about the gorilla, right?
So, all right, on to the bad martini now. And yesterday, Jim and I talked about the decision by your colleague at National Review, David French, not to become an independent presidential candidate. And we talked about the reasons that he laid out in his piece at nationalreview.com. He's been making the media rounds since writing about that decision. And this morning, he was with the gang at Morning Joe over on MSNBC. And Mika Brzezinski asked him about the report that emerged yesterday about people affiliated with Trump contacting members of French's family and urging him in no uncertain terms not to get in the race. Here's how it came up on the show today.
Did Trump operatives reach out to your family or you?
My wife's family, and yes, yes. Well, you know, it was probably one of the more ham-handed attempts at intimidation, which out of the Trump operation, you can expect things to be done the most incompetent way possible.
What happened?
An individual calls and said, I'm sorry, but I've been asked by the Trump campaign to make sure that, you know, David knows that this will be really, really bad for him.
And if it sounds like David French wasn't too bothered by that, he says it's because he's been dealing with this kind of vitriol from Trump supporters for months now.
I have been up against Trump for some time, and the assaults on my family have been overwhelming just as a writer. I mean, as everyone knows, Trump has an online racist mob that he often stokes by retweeting some of these horrible white supremacists. As that online racist mob is very fond of pointing out, I have a multiracial family. And so they have gone after my youngest daughter in the worst way imaginable. The worst way. It's one of the things.
They've attacked you for having a multiracial family.
Oh, you have no idea.
Ian, you obviously knew about that because he's mentioned that a couple times in his writings. This is probably one of the least surprising bad martinis given what we've seen over the past several months, but it's despicable nonetheless.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there will be books to be written about the alt-right and the way that Trump has used them to really just despicable effect. But this is a horrible thing, obviously, this intimidation attempt. But David's absolutely right, you know, that it happened in the most incompetent way possible. But it's important, I think, for this reason. It's ham-handed but effective in this sense, which is it was genuine hardball politics. And people would do well to remember, while Donald Trump is clownish, buffoonish, you know, all of these more lighthearted negative adjectives that we can think of. He's also a man who got his start in New Jersey and New York City real estate by negotiating with the mob. This is a guy on whose payroll for some time, who had whose business card was, you know, special assistant to Donald Trump, I think something like that. Felix Sater was affiliated with the Russian mob. And stabbed a man through the cheek with a broken martini glass. I mean, this is the kind of clientele with whom Trump has done business since he got his start in real estate. So it's important to keep that in mind and to keep that in mind in comparison with the alternative on the other side, which is a Clinton machine that is well known for its intimidation tactics as well. When I wrote a piece earlier this year about Juanita Broderick, she made clear in no uncertain terms, shortly after the rape that she alleges Bill Clinton perpetrated on her, Hillary Clinton greeted her and said, "I appreciate everything you've done for us," with, you know, the most pointed tone. I mean, these are two. So what you have are two candidates whose personal and professional lives are marked by this sort of too tight handshake, you know, this very pointed tone. And for those to be the options, for Americans to be thinking that by any stretch of the imagination, America's brightest days are ahead of it when the two candidates are these thugs in a whole lot of ways, is extraordinarily disheartening.
I don't want to brag, Ian, but in almost 6 years of doing this podcast, we have had a few broken martini glasses here, but usually from throwing them against the wall in frustration. But no one has ever been stabbed in the cheek or elsewhere. And knock on wood, hopefully that streak will continue for a while. So.
You know, well, once you guys do it, you can apply for a position in the Trump White House.
All right. Speaking of Trump, let's move to the crazy martini now and his comments late last week to Jake Tapper and others that the federal judge in the Trump University case can't possibly give him a fair shake because he's Mexican and Trump wants to build a wall and the wall would be between the United States and Mexico. Did not go over well, even with some of Trump's most ardent defenders, including Newt Gingrich, as we talked about on Monday's edition of the Three Martini Lunch. On Tuesday morning, not long before we recorded this podcast, House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked about Trump's comments and had this to say.
Claiming a person can't do their job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment. I think that should be absolutely disavowed. It's absolutely unacceptable. But do I believe that Hillary Clinton is the answer? No, I do not. Do I believe that Hillary Clinton is going to be the answer to solving these problems? I do not. I believe that we have more common ground on the policy issues of the day, and we have more likelihood of getting our policies enacted with him than we do with her.
So if you're a Trump supporter, you would probably want to latch on to the fact that the most high-ranking leader of your own party still thinks that Trump is the better choice than Hillary Clinton. But that's not how some of Trump's surrogates will look at it, because, of course, Trump is never wrong. Jeffrey Lord over at CNN decided that it's not Trump who is the racist.
Let me make no bones about it. Speaker Ryan is wrong, and Speaker Ryan has apparently switched positions and is now supporting identity politics, which is racist. I am astonished.
So you're accusing Paul Ryan? You're accusing Paul Ryan of racism?
I am accusing anybody who believes in identity politics, which he apparently now does, of playing the race card. The Republican establishment is playing this. Senator McConnell is playing this. These people have you know, run and hid and borrowed the Democratic agenda of playing the race card. It is wrong.
Carol Costello of CNN in there as well. So, Ian, apparently if you think someone else has made a racist comment by suggesting that someone's heritage means they're incapable of doing their job well, that makes you guilty of playing identity politics, which makes you a racist. You want to unpack that one for us?
I don't even know where to begin. I've made the mistake of going over this exchange and trying to understand it. But I think that was the problem, is it just can't be understood. This is obviously, you know, nuts. I mean, the idea that by attacking someone for playing the race card, which is obviously what Trump is doing in just deplorable terms, you are racist, is truly an astonishing rhetorical feat. But this is Jeffrey Lord, and yesterday Trump told his surrogates that he wants them doubling down on the attacks on this judge. And so he's taken that to new heights or new depths, depending on the position from which you view this. And he's done it in this way that's going to buoy Trump's supporters, the most cultish of Trump supporters' hopes and beliefs in this particular instance, which is he's just sounding the right notes, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a logical argument, but he's packing the establishment Republicans, Ryan and McConnell and all these folks, into a car with the left. He's affiliating them with left-wing tactics and all the rest. And there are, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe more people who are not going to give that a second thought, but are just going to snap their fingers and say that's quite right. And that's the game Trump has been playing from the beginning. It doesn't register with them that Trump's attacks are in some way precisely what the left has been doing with judges for the past several years. He's just sounded the right notes. And in this age of sort of call and response mobocratic politics, that'll probably be enough to lock down a few more people.
How many degrees of racism can we get in this story? Because Trump is accusing the judge, and we've got Ryan and a bunch of other people, of course, accusing Trump. Now you've got Lord accusing Ryan. We need somebody to accuse Lord now.
Oh, it's going meta. We're going deep here.
Ian, one of these days we might actually talk about an issue in this campaign. It's clearly not going to be today, but we can dream.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Have a good one. Thanks for subbing.
Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim should be back on Wednesday. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.